Welcome back to the program. In the entire history of the United States, only 44 men have known exactly what it feels like to have the full weight of national security on their shoulders. Even fewer have assumed office in a time of war. As Barack Obama took office, the threats of a terrorist attack swirled around him. A year later, the failed Christmas Day attack on Northwest 352 refocused Obama and the nation on the very real threat of domestic terrorism. Suddenly, it wasn't a policy paper or a briefing, but lives hung in the balance. How Obama is dealing with all of this is the subject of next Sunday's cover story in the New York Times Magazine by my guest Peter Baker. He's the White House correspondent for the New York Times, a contributing editor to the Times Magazine, and it is a pleasure to welcome Peter Baker back on this program. Peter Baker, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's good to have you here. One of the things you begin this story with is the story of a plot that was uncovered arguably around the inauguration that was really the first real threat that Obama had to deal with. Talk a little about that.
Well, that's exactly right. He wasn't even yet sworn into office when his own advisor slipped into the limousine the night before the inauguration. He was on his way to a bipartisan dinner marking the occasion of his ascension to office. And his advisors told him that, there was a very real possibility of a terrorist attack on his own inauguration the next day. The Nation's Intelligence Agency had been picking up chatter about a group of Somalis who were theoretically coming across the border from Canada in order to detonate bombs on the National Mall, just as the new president would be taking the oath of office. I mean, think about that. That's probably the most devastating target you can think of, practically. Nothing more seminal in American democracy than this peaceful transfer of power, and the very inception of a new presidency to have some sort of a terrorist attack on his ceremony swearing in, even if he himself was not hurt, would be a devastating blow to the United States. So it was a real serious moment.
And this came on top of a conversation that the president-elect had had with George Bush regarding vigilance and the need to stay vigilant every day.
That's right, exactly. During their conversations during the transition, the one thing that President Bush tried to impress on President Obama was that, you know, it was now his responsibility to protect the country from the threat of al-Qaeda and its allies, that every day you had to wake up very cognizant of what was out there and what needed to be done to stop it. And let's think about that. That's something that President Bush lived with after 9/11. He was there on the day that the Twin Towers came down and the Pentagon was hit. And that fourth plane crashed into the Pennsylvania countryside. It really seared his presidency from then on. So he tried to at least convey that sense of seriousness to President Obama. And he came away, President-elect Obama then, and he came away convinced that President-elect Obama understood the threat intellectually, but didn't necessarily yet feel it in his gut the way he might once he took office.
And some of it was having been immersed for a couple of years at that point in the politics of all this, and you've made the comment, I don't know if it's in the piece or in another comment I've heard you make, that in fact, while President Obama ran against Bush's first term, he inherited the second term, which was very different with respect to its dealings on terrorism.
Well, that's right. People think of the Bush presidency as a monolith, but in fact it was an evolution in policy and thinking and ideology. By the time President Bush left office, a lot of the harsher, more controversial elements of his war on terror, the phrase he used, had been modified or, in fact, eliminated. You know, there's a lot of talk about waterboarding even this year, but the fact is nobody had been waterboarded since President Bush's first term. The secret overseas prisons had been emptied. The military commissions had been authorized finally by Congress in accordance with what the Supreme Court had told him to do. The same with the wireless surveillance program. So, you know, a lot of the more controversial elements by that point had already started to be modified. And so when President Obama took over and the changes he instituted were really more in the nature of accelerating that evolution rather than the beginning of it.
And much of it was perception. You quote Mark Leiter in the piece, who was then the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, of saying, we're doing things well, but we're losing the messaging war.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the things that President Obama really wanted to do was change the tone, change the message, change the perception. That's why he went to Cairo to give a speech to the Muslim world to try to make the point that this is maybe a war on al-Qaeda, but it's not a war on Islam, and that there is a distinction and that we know that. Now, President Bush, by the way, you know, often made similar remarks. I mean, that was not something that was alien to him. He believed and talked about that a lot. But the fact of the matter is, by the time he left office, as a messenger, he had so much baggage that nobody was willing to listen. Nobody took it seriously. They either didn't believe him or they just weren't willing to listen. And, you know, the Iraq War having poisoned a lot of the goodwill toward America around the war, around the world. So President Obama had the advantage of being a new president. He, of course, was the first African-American president, first president of color in that sense, a president who had grown up at least for a few years in Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim country, most populous Muslim country, had himself Muslim relatives, also a constitutional lawyer. So, you know, his background inevitably meant that he was going to see these things in a different light.
And
it also presented a different profile. It also presented a different profile to the rest of the world.
And yet they both came to similar conclusions about this. I mean, you talk about the warrior ethos that George Bush came to it with and Obama's more lawyerly and kind of law enforcement approach, and yet they would come to similar conclusions about what really needed to be done.
Well, there's more continuity in policy than a lot of the political discussion would lead you to believe. I mean, a lot of the things that President Bush left in the Oval Office table, you know, on the counter, when he had a file folder saying counterterrorism, a lot of the things that were in there, President Obama has continued. You know, he has not only continued but expanded the program of drone strikes in the Pakistani tribal areas. He's increased, obviously, troops now to Afghanistan. He's continued to hold suspected terrorists without trial, and those that they don't believe can be prosecuted but also can't be released. And a lot of the things he's trying to do to change things that attract a lot of attention, like closing Guantanamo, these are things that actually the Bush administration was also at least somewhat trying to do at the same time. Now, President Bush never explicitly said we're going to do it within a year, as President Obama has, but he did say it was a goal of his, and under his administration about 500 detainees had been transferred or released. So there was more continuity to what was going on in terms of policy than a lot of people wanted to talk about.
Well, the president certainly has not been talking a lot about this during the course of the past year. To what extent has it been a paramount issue for the administration, and to what extent has what happened on Christmas Day really upped the ante and upped the focus on all of this as far as the administration is concerned?
I think that's right, exactly. One of the major differences, if not in policy, is in the way each president views the issue. President Bush saw terrorism, saw the threat of al-Qaeda as sort of an existential threat to the country. He equated it to the Nazis or communists in that sense. And President Obama looks at it in a different way. He thinks that terrorism is an important priority, but not the only important priority, and wants very much for it not to be the defining issue of his presidency. He believes that we need to keep a different balanced view of the threat, make sure we're aggressive to encountering it, but not allow it to sort of alter the landscape of American society the way the last few years.
To what extent is there does Obama bring a sense of historical precedence to the way he's looking at the war on terrorism? I mean, one need only look as far back as what went on in Northern Ireland and look at a different way of approaching terrorism.
Well, that's right, exactly. I mean, his is a more situational approach than a philosophical approach. I mean, look at, for instance, the decisions on whether or not to release Justice Department memos that had authorized these very harsh interrogation techniques that President Obama considers to be torture. He agreed to release those, but then reversed the decision to release photographs of the abuse because the commanders in Iraq and his own counterterrorism advisor were very concerned about that. So he tends to take these issues at one at a time, and he's trying to find a way to balance, as he sees it, security and liberties, and argues that, in fact, that one shouldn't have to be at the expense of the other.
Is there a sense that Obama's views have changed, shifted, or morphed in any way during the past year?
Well, you know, they would say no, but clearly the approach in the first few months that was focused very heavily on issues of pulling back from some of the more extreme versions of the Bush administration doctrine. You know, that seems to have given way to a moment when he is out to show a little bit more, you know, assertively that he is on top of terrorism. I think the Christmas Day plot, as you mentioned, has sort of refocused American attention to the possible threat here. And, you know, after a few days of not addressing this, President Obama came out pretty aggressively to address it repeatedly in public to say that he was going to make sure that the breakdown in intelligence and aviation security that had allowed this fellow with the bomb in his pants to get on the plane wouldn't happen again. So he's been more in the mode of the commander-in-chief fighting extremists in the last few weeks, as opposed to the constitutional lawyer trying to reestablish, in his view, a more rule of law approach to these things.
Of course, what's happened at the same time, as you point out near the end of this piece that's coming up on Sunday, is that the threat has shifted, that suddenly the idea of homegrown terrorism is a much greater threat.
Well, that's right, exactly. Look what happened, obviously, at Fort Hood. We had, that's an American citizen who opened fire on his fellow soldiers. Look what happened in terms of Najib al-Azazi, the airport coffee vendor who was arrested after having been trained, apparently, in Pakistan. David Coleman Headley, another, a series of others in Minnesota and Virginia and so forth, who are American citizens or at least legal residents of the United States, as opposed to, you know, the Muhammad Attas, as opposed to the Muhammad Attas of the world who were sent over here, to try to infiltrate the country. And that's a very different threat, and people are not quite sure how to approach it. Obviously, American citizens, have a greater ease in plotting bad things here in this country that are harder to track and harder to for the federal government to get their hands around.
One of the things you see in so many of the people that are dealing with this for Obama, John Brennan, who you talk about in the piece and who we've seen a lot of lately, and even, you know, Bob Gates and others, is a kind of professionalism that transcends ideology.
That's certainly the way they view it. That's certainly what they are trying to achieve. They are less likely to give talks about, you know, the ideological confrontation, the clash of civilizations type of approach that you saw at times in the last number of years. And instead, in fact, they're more interested in focusing on what John Brennan, the president's counterterrorism advisor, calls upstream factors, which are, you know, what they think are the conditions in a lot of these countries that fuel extremism. Now, President Bush also at times focused on those issues, but his profile is much more of the kinetic version, to use the phrase they use in the Pentagon. And President Obama, you know, he focused a little bit more on the idea of undercutting the appeal of al-Qaeda to Muslims in a broader way.
One of the things you talk about is that Obama feels the most comfortable when he's kind of splitting the difference and presenting it as a kind of non-dogmatic ideology. Is that approach applicable to dealing with terrorism?
Well, that's a good question. There are people out there who say, look, this is an all-or-nothing thing. They want to kill us, and it's silly to apply, textbook ideas of jurisprudence to, you know, that kind of a battle. And certainly had Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab managed to set off those explosives and blow that airliner out of the sky, there'd be a whole lot more people saying that today. I mean, that kind of threat is a wake-up call, obviously, and it's a reminder that these things are a threat, that there are, in fact, people out there who want to do grievous damage. But finding that balance is, as you say, President Obama's instinct, and it's not an easy balance to find. And it's not the first president to have to try to do that. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War, trying to figure out how to, you know, apply old American values to what was at the time an existential threat. President Obama is trying to figure out how to sort of restore what he sees as the constraints on government that had been there historically without opening new avenues of vulnerability.
Among the people that are dealing with all of this on the front lines, people like John Brennan, what is their view of the Obama policies?
Well, most of them are pretty positive about it in terms of the substance for certain. You know, a lot of the people who were still in these positions at the end of the Bush administration stayed on in the new one. There's a lot of continuity there beyond Bob Gates, and you mentioned John Brennan. He had been a senior CIA official under President Bush, set up the National Counterterrorism Center. You mentioned Mike Leiter, who is currently the director of the National Counterterrorism Center, appointed by President Bush. There's also a whole lot of other people, including the people in the White House, the State Department, at the Pentagon, and the Treasury Department, who were dealing with this war against al-Qaeda under the last administration. So, you know, these people feel comfortable with the direction that the new administration is going. And I talked to a number of former Bush administration people who left and who were very high up, but feel like that in a broad sense they're comfortable with the way things are going under the Obama administration. They don't like the tone. They don't like the rhetoric. They definitely don't like what they see as a blame Bush style of national conversation by the president. But in terms of the substance of the policies, a lot of, though not all, former senior Bush administration officials think that the substance is at least better than they had feared it might be.
Obama doesn't like to use the phrase war on terrorism. Talk about why not.
Well, as he points out, terror is a tactic rather than an enemy. That's what he would say. And he thinks that the phrase war on terror has come to be equated in much of the world as a war on Islam. And particularly when you say a global war on terror, it sounds like America versus the rest of the world. He wants to narrow that terminology to a war on al-Qaeda and its allies. Be very clear that the people that the United States is at war with are the people who are trying to blow us up, not Muslims in general. It's a semantic difference in a lot of ways, but it's one that kind of gets at the heart of a lot of the political dialogue, because that has lent ammunition to critics who say he doesn't really understand that we are at war. Although he uses the phrase war when he talks about war on al-Qaeda, these critics, led mostly by former Vice President Cheney, argue that in his gut, in his heart, he doesn't really understand the nature of the threat he's confronted with.
Rahm Emanuel, in your piece, talks about the importance of Obama's Cairo speech. Do you think that that speech still has resonance today?
Well, I think it was obviously an important moment. It was an important moment where he tried to set a tone that would be seen at least as a break with the past. There hasn't been a lot of similar speeches since then. That was last June. And I do think that the reaction to the Christmas Day bombing, in which they decided to increase security on anybody coming from 14 specific countries, most of them, almost all of them, Muslim in population, I think undercuts that appeal that he had tried to use the Cairo speech for. I think also his inability to convince Israel to back down on this issue of a settlement freeze has likewise frustrated a lot of folks in a lot of the Muslim capitals of the world. But he's still viewed more positively than President Bush, and he has the potential, if he chooses to use it, to really change that tone.
As you point out, the difficult part in all of this is that we have to be effective 100% of the time. They only have to be effective once.
Oh, that's exactly right. In Detroit, the Detroit Christmas Day plot shows that. I mean, you know, in hindsight, we had the intelligence that should have made clear what this guy was up to and what could happen, and we should have made sure he didn't get on a plane. But there are hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people who are flying every day, every week, every month, and forget the airlines. Beyond airlines, you have, you know, an open country, a country that is not an authoritarian state. And so the freedom that we all have is also, an invitation to extremists to try to exploit it and create violence or mischief. The fact of the matter is that the government has been pretty successful in wrapping up and stopping, you know, plots that have taken place over the last 8 years since 9/11. But, you know, nothing is going to be perfect. And President Obama, as we said in the article, he recognizes, I think, that, you know, at some point during his presidency, this could happen again.
Peter Baker, he's White House correspondent for the New York Times. His article, Inside Obama's War on Terrorism, is the cover story this coming Sunday in the magazine section of the New York Times. Peter, as always, I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Great being there.
Thank you.